Morning, I guess. Morning, Senator. What bill are you here for? And we will start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 808. That will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 808. And Mr. Putman will give us a brief introduction, and then we have Senator Yee here to talk to us.
Mr. Chairman, this allows debt consolidating agencies to charge a fee for classes they provide. Under the current law, they're allowed to make certain charges, but not this one. And as the financial market and instruments become more complicated, such things as reverse mortgages and so on, some education is needed, and it's the belief that a cover-the-cost charge should be allowed for these agencies.
Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
Come on up. Tell us about Senate Bill 808.
Mr. Chairman, is it all right for me to ask my constituent, Jane Ambulance?
Certainly.
And does John want to come? Sure.
Is this John Hawkins?
John Hawkins. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19, which consists of portions of Linn and Benton County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 808. Senate Bill 808 is a measure which will allow consumer credit counseling service agencies to charge a fee for approved educational classes that they can give. Under current law, they are not allowed to charge for their presentation. The mission of consumer credit counseling service agencies around the state is to provide independent, nonprofit community service to help families avoid and solve debt problems by providing guidance, education, counseling, and direct services. The advantage of Senate Bill 808 is that it will allow agencies to recapture some of their expenses for educating people about financial matters. Current law precludes counseling agencies from charging individuals for any discussions with them. They cannot even charge for printed materials. Some people have expressed concern that unscrupulous organizations might put together poor quality educational materials and sell them at a high price. However, this concern will be addressed by giving the Department of Consumer and Business Services authority to define a counseling session, an education session, types of materials to be used, and the price of appropriate education materials and educational sessions. Bankruptcies are projected to increase nationally by 4.6% in 1999, by 19.7% in year 2000, and by 30.4% in 2001. The educational efforts addressed in this bill show families how to avoid debt and resolve their debt problems. Senate Bill 808 will help consumer credit counseling service agencies to provide better help to the consumer because reimbursed for their educational classes, they will be able to offer more seminars and workshops and help more of their clients. Senate Bill 808 passed the Senate unanimously and is supported by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I urge your passage, 808. And at this time, I would like to introduce Jan Amlin from the Consumer Credit Counseling Services in Albany and John Hawkins, who's Board of Director of the Consumer Counseling Service.
Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. My name is Jan Amling, and I'm the Executive Director of Consumer Credit Counseling Service. We are part of a network of not-for-profit agencies that work with families requesting assistance with their finances. We assess the family's situation and make suggestions for restructuring the way they spend their monies. For some families, additional income will be necessary to keep their creditors happy. For others, bankruptcy may be appropriate. For those families who choose, we offer a debt management program where many creditors will reduce or eliminate interest so the family will make better progress with their bills. During the past 3 months, the families we counseled averaged being short $509 per month of paying their debts to their creditors. Of the families counseled, 50% had experienced a reduction in income, 25% had overspent, and the other 25% experienced divorce, low income, increased expenses, lost benefits, illnesses, or bad checks.
Jan, we have your written testimony. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Sure.
In addition to it?
Okay. I thought that everything that I said had to be documented with 25 copies. at the present time, the Consumer Credit Counseling Service agencies are experiencing a squeeze financially because the primary source, 75% of our funding has come from the creditors who receive money back from us. They give us a charitable contribution. And because they're experiencing such high rates of bankruptcies and other losses, they are taking a hard look at their whole financial situation and cutting back the contribution that they give to us. So we cannot charge for education. We cannot charge for any discussion with the family, whether it's a counseling session or education. So the only other way that we have to fund education is to charge the families that we put on a debt management program a higher amount. We're allowed by law to charge them 15% of what they give us. So if they bring us $1,000 a month, we take $150. We could take that $150 and go out and educate the public. So we're putting the burden of education, we would in that case be putting the burden of education on the backs of the people that are already financially strapped. So right now, we in our office cap our fees that we charge families on the program to $20 a month. So to jump to $150 so that we could pay for educating people that walk in off the street that maybe just want some budgeting help seems a little bit strange.
So this bill is designed not to charge people who are in bankruptcy or in problem, but maybe to get people before they get there?
Right. It would treat people before they get there or people that are already there so they don't do it again. There's a number of repeat offenders, we might say.
Because when I first saw it, the first thing that came to my mind was we've got people here that are already in, you know, in consumer credit. I mean, they've got problems already. How can we now be charging them for classes when they can't afford to pay the bills they already have? But the idea is to try to get the people before they get into trouble?
Right, right. And another component that this would address is if the federal bankruptcy legislation would pass, there's two places that we would interface with all bankrupts. One would be they would have to have a counseling session within 2 weeks of the time they requested before they could file for bankruptcy. And, of course, there would still be no charge for that because we don't charge for counseling. But on the back end, before their case could be discharged, every one of them would have to have money management classes. Again, we would not be able to charge those people. We wouldn't be able to charge anybody for the counseling or the educational sessions.
Mr. Chairman, following your question. So specifically, who pays the money? Where's the money come from for these education classes?
Our total funding, approximately 79% of all of our funding comes from the credit grantors and probably 21% comes from the families that we charge the monthly fee of approximately $12. So everything we do comes out of those revenues.
But the education classes would be paid by the students.
We would like
to. People who take classes, they would like to charge the students.
I brought along some examples of the materials that we use right now and what our cost is. The government gives us a good book on the first-time home buyer and housing per dollar. The same, another fellow, Dahlstrom, puts out really good books. These are $2.11. Master Your Money, I think this one is $5. For all clients that come into our program for counseling and indicate they have a money management problem, we give them this book for $2.19. And this is an example of something that we put together in our own office for a session that we held last month. And it, I can't remember if it was about 20 sheets of paper, and if you say it's a nickel a page, that's at least a dollar plus a cover. So most of our costs are relatively low for the materials we use. You know, it would be nice to be able to charge for the materials and something for the time or in travel.
Mr. Chair, could I address that? The
Will you state your name for the record, please?
John Hawkins.
Thank you.
The funding source for consumer credit counseling services, as Jan has stated, what may not be clear is, we call that, that comes from a prorate program. Those are people who have come into consumer credit counseling services, and they're turning over a certain portion of their income that we pay their bills for, okay? And in return, the creditors are then making donations to consumer credit counseling services. What we're talking about is a population of people who come in, and we talk with them, we may show them how to be on a budget, but they don't end up being on an ongoing program. They leave, or we may not be able to set them up on a program. If we go out to do presentations, we are not charging any fees for that. So what we're talking about getting the funding for are those folks who come in and are clearly receiving an educational service from us. They're not being set up to pay where we're paying their credit. Just to clarify, so the population we're talking about that would be paying for this are those folks now who come through and are receiving a service, but charged for it. Is that accurate, Jan?
We will never charge for counseling. If in the counseling session we identify that they need some education classes, that would be a separate appointment with us, and that can be done individually or can be done in group sessions.
So the money's for the education part, which the bill I think is dealing with, is going to come from those who are participating in education and maybe supplemented by your other income that you have. Is that a true statement?
Correct.
And what do you anticipate charging them? Maybe that's an unanswered question.
We would have to converse with the state on this. I could see maybe $10 per person per session. One of the things that we've offered in the past is called a money control workshop, and that's 4 weeks in a row of 2 hours a night. And I don't know that that would be $40, but we would. The workbook for that is $5, and usually we serve cookies and punch, and you know, there's some other costs. So whether that would be $10, $15, we're not looking at charging people $250 to come to our seminar on whatever. That's not what we're in the business for. We're much more low key than that.
Just one point. Go ahead. The idea, and I think that's, you know, I shouldn't applaud that, because I think a lot of times it's not lack of money, it's lack of how they spend their money rather than lack of money. But I'm just wondering, when you make a charge for these people who already obviously are having resource problems, do you think they're going to decrease significantly the number that come to the sessions?
Usually we have some kind of I would suspect that we would have a scholarship type program if a person qualified, you know, demonstrated a particular need, or they could defer giving us money till later, to us as a contribution later. It probably would not stop people from coming. The fee is pretty low, and the state will be in charge of what we're going to be allowed to charge for what types of sessions.
That when you say the state will be in charge, I'm reading sub 5, sub B, request to charge fee has been approved in writing by the director. Is that before you can charge the class, you're going to tell them what the class is going to be and what your proposed fee, and they're going to have to approve that?
I'm not quite sure what that's going to look like. I'm not sure how much work Mr. Kruger's office wants to get involved with, but there will be some kind of guidelines, and we would submit all of our materials to them, and I would assume that they would assign some kind of a value that we could charge.
Do you have any other testimony you'd like to give? We kind of cut you off before you had a chance to say anything.
In addition to the written comments, I will just add that one of the things we picked up on in the last 3 or 4 years is trying to break into the college campus setting. Our experience has been many folks as students, in addition to their student loans when they come out, have been receiving credit cards and loans from their parents, I'm sure. And they've been supplementing their income. They may graduate depending on $10,000 in terms of debts in terms of their education, but also credit card debt. And that was a personal experience I had in my office with a co-worker's daughter who had at least that amount of debt when she graduated, and put her in contact with the consumer credit counseling office. And 4 years later, she's now out of debt, But what they need for me is, I don't want to wait until they're coming in. They've got 10 or 20,000 applicants with young folks at their sorority or fraternity or living group. So they understand to use credit wisely and not get that debt to close. So that's one of the things we're advertising in school newspapers. And we're trying to get into the living groups so that we can work with the folks there. Well, let's face it, credit card people and renters understand that these are folks who are going to graduate and have potential excellent earnings, so they're going to try to get those. So we're going to get things.
One other issue, if I can just tail on to what Mr. Lundquist was asking. Typically, as an inducement to our clients to come in for counseling sessions, follow-up sessions, we waive the monthly fee if they'll come in for it, and that has a pretty good response. We would probably do something like that for people when we advertise that we're doing a presentation. If they come in, we would waive their fee for the month. So they would not actually pay. They would actually get something better than that. They would get something free.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm glad John mentioned the group of people they talk to. Not only do they talk to college students, high school students, I think you said to me they also talk to the welfare parents, the displaced workers, the first-time home buyers, and what other groups whose income might have been reduced because of different employment reasons. So it's kind of a preventative measure.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Talk to them to know how to manage their finances better and not get into
that. And typically we would not be charging the Head Start or welfare people anything for the fee, but if their program had money, we could ask them to for the program to pay for our materials, which I don't think at this point we can even ask.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I don't know if Mr. Kruger from the Department of Business and Consumers has signed up for testimony.
He signed up to testify. Uh-huh.
And the other thing that I would point out is that there's some written testimony from the offices in Coos Bay, Medford, and Bend supporting this.
We appreciate that.
And Salem's here, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Kruger? Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
For the record,
James Kruger, Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I'm the program manager for the Debt Consolidation Agency.
You have signed up here in support of the bill. Do you have anything to add besides that?
No, except I think your concern about the cost to people who may not be able to afford it is well placed, and the division intends to look very closely. We don't anticipate this is going to be a profit center for these folks. They essentially have been doing an unfunded federal mandate in the reverse mortgage program. That is, there's a requirement in federal law that they provide counseling. They're recognized providers, but Oregon law says they can't charge for it. It'll be the same situation with bankruptcy law. So we're going to look closely at the costs and the materials and make sure that it's a credible program and not exorbitantly priced.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 808? Seeing no one, we will close the public hearing. One more session. Reverend Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 808 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves Senate Bill 808 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, clerk call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Cano?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Marcet?
Excuse
me. Representative Thompson?
Excuse.
Chair
Byron? Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 808 moves the House floor. They do pass recommendation. Any volunteers?
Oh, sure.
Representative Gardner will carry it, Bill. Thank you very much, Senator. We will now go to Senate Bill 281.
Mr. Chairman, this bill would set up the same limitations on public disclosure when DCBS examines an insurance company as banks now enjoy when they're also examined by DCBS.
We have Nancy, I have her name right here someplace, Ellison, and Joe
Ariel.
Ariel?
Yep.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Nancy Ellison, the administrator of the Insurance Division of DCBS, and this is Joel Ariel, the manager of our Consumer Protection and Enforcement Section. You've got our testimony in front of you, and I won't repeat most of what's there. Just let me note that SB 281 did pass the Senate 26-2. It's a good bill. We do appreciate your finding time to consider it. In the Senate, the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association asked us to make a change that would give the director of DCBS the discretion to override this presumption of confidentiality that we're asking for if there were a compelling public interest to disclose something. And we agreed to that, and the version of the bill that you have in front of you does include the compromise worked out with the Newspaper Publishers Association.
Thank you. Questions? Person Berner.
We're talking about all different types of insurance. What types of insurance are we talking
about? Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, this would cover all types of insurance. This covers examiner work files and work papers. These are voluminous papers that are collected in the course of auditing an insurance company, either for financial or market conduct exams. They would include things possibly like a person's medical record or parts of a medical record, parts of a claim file, account numbers, other sensitive information. Right now, they're protected as long as the examination is in process. But as soon as the exam is completed and published, they're no longer protected en masse. We would like to just extend that protection, make it permanent.
So if there is a, let's take workers' compensation, for instance, there's a contested case, it is available to attorneys involved in a case, or is it subject to subpoena? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, these particular files would not be involved in the workers' comp contested case process. These are other types of insurance. They would not be subject to subpoena from the director. They might still be subject to subpoena from another type of private lawsuit, but we would at least be able to protect them in the department.
Just one more. So in like a health insurance case, it would be subject to subpoena.
Representative Gardner, not from the department. It would be protected from the department.
Questions? Any more testimony you'd like to give? Here to answer questions. Okay. You'll join and state your name for the record?
Joel Ariel.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 281? If no one, we'll close the public hearing on 281. Lower session, Senate Bill 281.
I'll move 281 with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Longquist moves Senate Bill 281 with a due pass recommendation to the House floor. Discussion on the motion. Representative Gardner, would you like to?
Well, basically, I just have some concerns about exempting things from disclosure, and I just vote no.
Back. The discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Cano?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Atkins?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 281 moves to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Lundquist, do you have to carry the bill? Representative Lundquist, carry. Close the work session. Excuse me. We'll now go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 577. Open public hearing.
Uh, Mr. Chairman, this bill allows funds, fees on permits that are issued to flow into a specially designated manufactured structures and parks education account. And there is a conflict amendment on this. And I think our time would be better served if we understood the bill first, and then I'll explain the conflict amendment, which will not change what the bill does.
Okay. Let's have Don Miner and Dana Roberts come up and tell us about the bill.
Good morning, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing to speak in support of Senate Bill 577. We ask that this legislation be introduced. As your staff pointed out, this bill will establish a manufactured structures and parks education account within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. These collected from the industry for training purposes will be placed into the fund. The department will then be able to contract for the expenditure or for the purchase of training for the industry without going through the competitive bidding process. The bill does require, though, that the director of DCBS seek the advice of the Manufactured Structures and Parks Advisory Board before expending these monies. Manufactured housing in Oregon is an extremely large industry. Last year, manufacturers built about 11,856 homes worth more than $611 million within this state. They exported 5,600 of these homes worth about $300 million. These manufacturers employed over 3,200 employees with a payroll of $93 million. Retailers employed about 800 people with a payroll of $25 million. And we have associated electrical contractors, excavators, et cetera. So it's a very, very large industry. Finding a skilled workforce mix is a very major problem for the industry. Each year, the industry, to address this problem, puts about $45,000 into the department for training purposes. During the last few years, the department has, through an interagency agreement, had a contract with the Department of Economic Development for the expenditure of these funds. Economic Development then contracted with the Industries Education Foundation, which contracted with Lynn Benton Community College for development of training. The Department of Economic Development has indicated that they really want out of this arrangement, that it's matured enough that we ought to be able to do it on our own. The problem is the agency under current law is bound by the competitive bidding statute. And it's not worth $45,000 a year. It's not worth going through the process. So what this would do would streamline the process for the agency. We believe that there'd be adequate controls over the expenditures. We think it would work very efficiently, and we support the bill.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dana Roberts, Acting Deputy Administrator of the Building Codes Division. I won't go through my written testimony, but I'd like to highlight a couple of points. We have been providing this service or arrangement for the last two biennia. The curriculum has been developed by Lynn Benton Community College, and specific trainers have been established that are currently providing training to the industry throughout the state. That's why we believe that continuation of this mechanism by having the department do it directly to benefit the industry and the competitive bid process is not necessary in this situation, as it is agent or industry-specific training that has been developed in conjunction with the industry and the curriculum already exists, as well as the trainers. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Don, when you're building your manufactured homes, is the wiring, is it licensed electricians and licensed plumbers doing the wiring and the plumbing in your plant?
No, that is not required by federal law. The Department of Housing and Urban Development oversees the designs of manufactured homes. They have a contract with the state of Oregon, who is provide personnel continuously in the plants to oversee the construction of the homes, the wiring, the plumbing, et cetera, thermal performance.
But they don't have to be done by licensed contractors or inspected by building inspectors?
They are they don't have to be done by licensed contractors. They're done by production personnel. We've been building those homes in that fashion since the 1950s in this state. But they are inspected by the state of Oregon continuously.
When they're inspected, is the plant inspected or is each home inspected?
The plant, both, actually. The plant is inspected, as I understand the process, as well as some aspect of every home and every aspect of the homes. Dana probably oversees that and could explain it better.
Chairman, maybe I can help out a little bit. Federal law requires the state inspector to inspect every station within the plant every time they're in the facility to make sure work going on in those stations are according to the federal code, as well as every home under production in that facility. So we currently have 16 inspectors continuously in the 12 manufacturing plants in Oregon doing that work.
So it's safe to say that, every day homes are being inspected, but not every home is inspected.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Every home is inspected, but not all of the work in the home may be visually inspected by the inspector.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Putnam, we now have is it an LC draft amendment or
it's a conflict amendment.
Okay. To hand that out, walk us through it. Is there anyone else who'd like to testify in this bill? Seeing no one, will public hearing open a work session on Senate Bill 577. Mr. Putnam, would you like to go through the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, this conflict amendment starts off saying that if Senate Bill 512 becomes law, that bill has passed the Senate and is now in the House General Government Committee, and it calls for a surcharge on the permit fees collected in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. The disposition of that surcharge is in the same statute that our bill is dealing with. So what this conflict amendment does is modifies this bill, taking into account that those extra surcharges in the Tri-County area go into a different fund. It does not affect either the source or the distribution of the permit fees that this bill deals with, that our bill deals with.
Okay.
It took me about 2 hours to figure that out. That's what it does.
And what about page 2 of the amendment? Is that still?
That's still all part of it.
Okay. That's the training surcharge.
Okay.
Yeah. The notwithstanding 4A, that is the surcharge.
Okay. Any members, we have before us the bill and the dash A2 amendment.
So just one question, Mr. Putnam. Basically, should 512 pass, this solely deals with the manufactured housing portion of 512 and the fees dealing with manufactured housing within that, right?
Correct, sir.
Okay. Read. Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash A2 amendment.
Representative Gardner moves the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 577. There's a discussion on the motion. Objections? Seeing none, so ordered. We now have an amended bill.
I move Senate Bill 577 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves Senate Bill 577 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Knoll?
Aye.
Representative Lumpkin?
Aye.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Haven't received the required number of votes. Senate Bill 573.
Excuse me, please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, Representative Morissette, I apologize.
I've only got four votes.
Aye. Apologize, Representative Morissette. I didn't realize she didn't call your name. Still haven't received the required number of votes. Senate Bill 577 moves before the due pass recommendation. Is this bill the Secretary of the Bill? Okay. We're not sure this morning. We have 410, correct?
All right. Okay. Could we do the I guess that is 729. Yeah.
We've got 459.
August
is next on the list.
Yeah, sure.
So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 459. Mr. Butler.
Mr. Chairman, more manufactured dwelling park stuff. Right now, in the state building code are various specialty codes, and the specialty code allows local governments to make local tweaking or changes in the building code. This bill adds manufactured dwelling park regulations into that state building code. It makes them a specialty code, part of the state building code.
That's right.
That is right.
Okay. Don Miner. Certainly. I'm trying to figure out Mr. Payne. Jeff, okay. And Don Comstock, did it come up at the same time?
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner for Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of Senate Bill 459. As your staff pointed out, passage of this legislation will require that municipalities use the state standards when regulating the construction of manufactured home parks. I'll tell you a few things that the bill doesn't do. It doesn't apply to manufactured home subdivisions or partitions, or manufactured homes located outside of parks. And it also does not limit local government's ability to regulate the type and style of homes that go within parks. The state of Oregon has regulated the construction of manufactured home parks in the state since about 1953. ORS 446062 requires that the director of DCBS adopt park construction standards. These rules govern things such as streets, lighting, drainage, fire separation, playgrounds for children, etc. No municipality is allowed to have a lesser standard than the state standards, but because it's not a preemptive standard, they can have different standards as long as they're not a lesser standard. Many jurisdictions have adopted their own standards, and in some cases, these standards far exceed the state standards. For example, many of them are requiring that park streets, the roadways within the park, which are essentially private drives, they meet city street standards. They're essentially designed for long, long duration carrying heavy traffic. We think these standards are excessive. They add to the cost of the park and consequently increase rents within the park. And it's important to remember, though, that these streets are never to be maintained by the local government. They'll be maintained by the park owner, park developer. If they're damaged, it's the park owner's problem. Now, usually they'll design these streets to carry garbage trucks, manufactured homes, those types of loads. In addition, the state of Oregon is the chief building official for about 40% of the state. When they review a manufactured home park within a community, they have to review it to make sure it meets the state standard, in addition, that it meets the local government standard. And it's my understanding that this creates some burden for them in terms of becoming familiar with that local standard. In addition, when the state amends its standard, bumps it up, the local governments have to amend their standards. So there's some confusion out there as to what the standard is. Now, there are precedents for this type of legislation. State building code is an example of that. prior to the 1970s, cities could have their own building code that could differ from the state standard. But under current law, the state standard is both a minimum and a maximum. Cities are able to take an exception to that building code, that there's something unique about their community. An advantage of the Uniform Building Code is that it reduces costs for construction of new homes. We believe Senate Bill 459 could have the same impact in our industry. Another precedent would be Senate Bill 849. That passed the 1997 legislature, and it added 455-680 to the list of specialty codes. You'd find that in your bill at page 1, line 25. What that did was say that RV parks are a state specialty code now, so cities and counties are required to use only the state RV park standards when approving one. I'm not saying that a manufactured home park and RV park are identical, but they are both private communities, private roads, and have private roads. If this legislation were to go forward and the state standards were to prove to be inadequate for some reason, those standards can be amended by the director of DCBS. In addition, like the building code, a jurisdiction that has something unique about it could go to the director and ask for an exception. We think that this bill will make the construction and manufacturing home parks easier, simpler. People will be able to know in advance what the standards will be and hopefully reduce costs, and we support it. We urge your support as well. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you. Don, could you give me some examples of cities, I mean, name some cities that require full street, curb, sidewalks, tree plantings, whatever.
Chair Beyer, Representative Morissette, my understanding is Troutdale is one of those cities, Fairview. I have speakers with me that can probably speak better to the particulars of that. Okay. It's not uncommon. I think down in your area, Cresswell might be one.
I'll have to check with Springfield. Could I ask another question? These are probably safety standards for fire trucks and other large vehicles. You mentioned garbage trucks, ambulance, fire, whatever.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chair Beyer, Representative Morissette, I believe that's correct, that the state does regulate the width of streets as well. I think the minimum width is 20 feet. I know that Eugene, I think, is looking at a 16-foot wide width that would be less than the state standard, and that would work against our interest in that direction. But yes, we believe the state standards are designed to accommodate access to the property for fire trucks as well.
Thanks.
Hey, Mr. Payne, would you like Jeff?
Good morning. My name is Jeff Payne. I'm a builder, owner, operator of manufactured home communities, as well as I sit on the Manufactured Structures and Parks Advisory Board in the state of Oregon. And I thought I would speak a little bit about some of those costs, the difference. In some communities, they'll require a 36-foot street width. And I try to compute that into a monthly rental factor. And I do that to illustrate what it would take to break even and when developing a park. And the difference between a 20-foot wide street and a 30-foot wide street is a monthly rental factor of about $12.19. For a 36-foot wide street, that works out to be about $18. That's per home per month. Some of the communities require a 16-inch subdivision-style curb, and that has a monthly rental factor of about $6 per home per month. Other communities require a 4-foot sidewalk, and you know, that relates to a number of about $7.50 per foot. I had an experience recently where a park was approved, but the condition was that we build the infrastructure, the underground piping, to public standards. And then the city turned around and said, we want you to put in a master water meter vault, which itself is about $130,000 impact to the park with all the SDC fees. However, they were not going to own the pipes on the other side of the master water meter vault, so therefore they were causing an excessive expense to our development, and in meeting with the building official, they did back down on the standard for the on-site improvements. So I urge your support of Senate Bill 459.
Could you tell me which city that was?
City of Fairview.
When you're using your so much per space per month figures, I mean, there's got to be an average-sized park of how large, or does that matter, the size of the park?
That really doesn't matter. Somewhat the configuration would matter, how many homes you would have per side of street, if you will. So you would, you know, share either the full street width or not. I was estimating a 50-foot wide frontage lot.
Questions? Thank you. Comstock, you have some testimony?
Good morning. My name is Don Comstock. I'm also a developer, owner, and manager of Manufactured Housing Communities. Washington County has the propensity at this point of requiring us to build streets, to go to the earlier question, of building them to a very high standard of public streets. As pointed out previously, that cost gets quite high. By state law today, we're allowed to build a community of the approximate size of 1 acre or better. If the community that we're building in allows us only to build 5 homes per acre, which is usually a nominal number, the smallest, those prices can go as high as $27 per unit per month. And one of the things that we're trying to provide is effective low-cost housing for people that allows them the opportunity to start and own their own home, have pride of ownership, and go on from there. When rents begin to escalate over the $450 range, and it's not uncommon to see that in new communities because of the separate requirements in the given areas, it no longer becomes an effective rent. It takes them right out of that issue. But the point being is by study, for instance, the width of the street, the narrower the street, the slower the traffic. And that's been proven by studies here in the United States. I wish I'd have brought it with me this morning, but I didn't. I apologize. The wider the street, the faster the people go through it. So if you have a medium-sized community, or what we would call in the state of Oregon an average-sized community, which is approximately 52 units in a community, you have to put speed bumps and so forth in to slow them down. By making smaller streets or narrower streets, you reduce that issue. Again, all of it goes to cost. And then we're here too.
Thank you. Are you talking about off-street parking with a 20-foot street or on-street parking?
Most of the time it's off-street parking. There is we're required to have a minimum of two parking spaces per unit, and then additional parking spaces for guests and so forth throughout the community. And that is in the state code at present.
Could I are these rentals? You seem to be talking about rentals rather than owner occupied.
They own their own homes.
They rent the space.
That's correct.
Okay, so the cost per month then is, I understand that.
Yeah, and then it directly relates to what they pay. So yeah. If the rent is over $450 a month or so, it's no longer competitive in the right sense.
Don, I don't have anyone from the League of Oregon Cities or the Association of Counties signed up here. Have you? Did they testify in the Senate? Obviously they're aware of the bill. It's been on schedule for a week, but.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, there was no opposition in the Senate either. There was no testimony in opposition, at least.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Dana or Robert?
Yeah.
morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dana Roberts. I'm the Acting Deputy Administrator of the Building Codes Division. You have my written testimony, so I won't be going through it verbatim. I'd just like to point out a couple of points. This bill is before you because in the early 1990s, we received an Attorney General's opinion that indicated that if a code adopted by the state was not specifically identified under 455.010, again, in this case, line 24 of the bill, as a specialty code, then local jurisdictions could adopt amendments to exceed the code adopted by the state of Oregon. As Mr. Miner indicated, the 97th session of the legislature addressed one of the codes that was not identified as a specialty code covering RV parks. This bill would add the last code that building codes has that has not been designated as a specialty code for manufacturing parks.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else like to testify in Senate Bill 459? Seeing no one, will close the public hearing. Open work session.
Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 459 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves Senate Bill 459 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion, Representative Morissette.
I will support the measure going to the floor, but I can't guarantee I'll vote for it. I'm going to check it out with my own community, first of all, and the legal origin cities and counties.
Thank you. For the discussion, and then for the roll.
Representative Blackwood?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative
Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Mayor? Aye. I've received the required number of votes. Senate Bill 459 moves before the due pass recommendation. And I'm not to carry one. I will carry it. Close the work session. We will now have a public hearing on Senate Bill 729. Mr. Butler.
Mr. Chairman, this bill requires or allows, actually requires, the Employment Department to disclose an individual's wage information upon request of that individual and for a specific credit purpose.
Okay. Jennifer Weber and Randy Elmer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Jennifer Weber, representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys. I'm not sure that the committee administrator summarized the correct bill.
I think the committee administrator was looking at the wrong bill file.
I'm on the wrong bill. I apologize.
Let's start over here.
Give him the opportunity to do that before we...
I hope this happened tomorrow. My evaluation is late this afternoon, if any of you want to change what you may have already said. Yeah. I do apologize.
Let's try 729. I noticed a confused look back there. They're really wondering what we were talking about.
Okay. I'm properly embarrassed. There is a conflict amendment on this, and I'll tell you what that is right now. When we passed Senate Bill 460, we eliminated the essence of Section 2 and 3 of this bill, and the conflict amendment simply takes Section 2 and 3 out. That leaves the basic nature of the bill, which is to eliminate the current two-year limit on partial disabilities for injured workers.
That's the right bill now?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for the record, Jennifer Weber. I would just like to share with you, first of all, that this bill did go through the Management Labor Advisory Committee and receive its approval and was passed by the Senate with no opposition. And that's all I have to add at this point.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Randy Elmer. I'm here on behalf of AWACA. I'm AWACA's president, and on behalf of myself as a practicing attorney who's practiced workers' compensation law for 16 and a half years, representing mainly claimants. I'm here to speak in support of this bill. I have provided some written testimony to you this morning, so I would just like to highlight the need for this bill. As was mentioned, under the current law, there is a two-year aggregate cap on temporary partial disability. And I would like to begin by just explaining the fundamental difference in the type of time loss that injured workers receive. When an injured worker is medically verified not to work, they receive a full two-thirds of the wage they were earning at time of injury, and we refer to that as temporary disability. If they are given a modified release, they have some capacity to work during that period of time. Any time loss they receive is referred to as temporary partial disability, and the two-year cap is on the temporary partial disability. Frankly, this is somewhat of an archaic relic from early work comp law. We know that it was codified in 1953 as part of ORS Chapter 656, but back beyond that, it's hard to find any reason for why we have it. One must assume it was to give workers who had some kind of a modified release some incentive to get back to work, because if they were only going to get 2 years of benefits, they'd want to get back to earning wages. We now have a lot of mechanisms in the administrative rules and in the statutes that insurers may use to limit the amount of exposure for temporary partial disability. But let me say, probably the most necessary reason for this bill is in a very few number of very serious injury cases, this creates quite an injustice to the injured worker. Let me just give you a quick example. I represent a gentleman who was on a claim for 8 years. He was knocked off the back of a tractor-trailer rig that was loaded with lumber and fell to his feet, having serious calcaneal fractures and ankle fractures. Over the course of 8 years, he underwent 8 surgeries to his right ankle. The final surgery will be amputation. Between many of those surgeries, the doctors were asked to give modified releases to allow him to continue in his participation with his voc rehab program. Now, he did that. There was no contemplation he would return to modified work. There was no contemplation by the employer of reemploying him because of the serious injury. However, near the end of the 8 years, when he was looking forward to claim closure and receiving his permanent partial disability benefits, he received a notice of closure that said, for your scheduled and unscheduled injuries, some were unscheduled because of depression, you would be owed $42,000 for all the permanent partial disability you have suffered. Unfortunately, we have paid $38,000 beyond the two-year cap of temporary partial disability. That was the label placed on that time loss. Therefore, that's an overpayment, and we will take that back from your permanent partial disability, leaving you $4,000 after these some 8 years. That's just one example, but it happens about 10 times annually, as we understand it. As I mentioned, there's a lot of mechanisms available to allow the insurers to get workers back to work. If they can get the doctor to sign off on a job description for a modified job, the worker refuses to take it. There's administrative rules that allow the insurers to stop paying time off at that point. We urge this committee to pass the bill out. We have never chosen to cap those totally disabled workers with 2 years of benefits. There simply is no reason to do it to those who are partially disabled. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Morissette. I didn't understand who you were with when you started. You gave us some acronym, and I don't know what that means.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, I am the president of the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys. Ms. Weber is our lobbyist, and I'm serving as our president currently. And I'm also a workers' compensation attorney here in Salem, where I practiced for 16 years representing claimants.
Okay.
I apologize. I represent us that I should have caught that acronym and pressed it. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify in this bill? No one from him wants to talk about it, huh? Mr. Shipwreck is not in the room. We can't volunteer him.
Oh, this is great.
It's so much more fun to have my boss come up. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 729, open work session. This side of the room's been pretty quiet. You want to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I do. I feel pretty strong about this. I'm going to move SB 729. Oh, no, we got to move a dash one, don't we?
Yes, we do have a dash one conflict amendment.
Yeah, I'll move the dash one in the Senate.
Representative Knope moves. the dash one amendments to the Senate Bill 729. Is there discussion on the motion? Objections? See none, so ordered. Representative Canole.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 729 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Canole moves Senate Bill 729 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Call the roll.
Representative Marquez?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Representative Gardner?
Yes.
Representative Canole?
Aye.
Representative
Lundquist?
Aye.
Mayor Byers?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, Senate Bill 729 moves the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteers to carry the bill. Representative Morissette, would you like to carry that bill?
Yes.
Okay. That will carry the bill. We'll now go to Senate Bill 1086. Mr. Putnam was in a big hurry to get to that one last time. So.
I've already explained this with Mr. Chairman. For the record, 1086 requires the Employment Department to disclose wage information when the wage earner provides a written and voluntarily given consent for that disclosure, and it has to be for a specific transaction. We couldn't just send in a blanket, tell anyone what they asked for.
Okay, this is the assignment sheet. We'll find out who wants to talk about it. All cause through. Sure. As Betsy rolls out in the hall, she signed up to testify, and I don't.
Yes, I don't see it, but she did leave me for testimony. Okay, your permission, I'll pass it.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cosgrove, representing on this bill DIE Limited Liability Company. DIE is a joint venture of First American Financial, whose most well-known subsidiary is First American Title Insurance Company, and Norwest Mortgage, which is now a subsidiary of a Minneapolis bank called Wells Fargo. It used to be a subsidiary of a Minneapolis bank called Norwest. This bill is brought to you to address an issue having to do with verification of income and employment on certain loan applications, in particular mortgage loan applications, and in particular FHA and federal VA loan applications. With respect to those loan applications, which generally require very little down payment, the standards of the federal government and the insuring agencies are very strict about verification of a variety of pieces of information needed to approve a loan. And one of those is verification that employment and income over a period, generally 2 to 3 years, has been reported accurately. And it needs to be third-party verification. In other words, just providing the wage slips is not pay stubs for those loan programs. The current process of getting that verification is as follows. The lender asks the borrower or borrowers to sign consent forms, release forms, which are sent to the employer, generally by mail. Those are routed generally to the employer's personnel or payroll department. Somebody fills it out. Sometimes these are employees who have already left employment and gone on to a different job, and they have to dig out the older personnel files. The forms are filled out and then mailed back to the lender. And in during a period of time, the loan cannot be finally approved, nor can it be closed. What this does is allow access to electronic access to this same information. And the source of that information is the Employment Department. In Oregon and in all other states, employers are required to report by employee wage and salary information on a quarterly basis, and that's for the purpose of verifying unemployment insurance premiums. And this would allow access to that under a very specific set of restrictions that the U.S. Department of Labor has imposed, and I'd like to very briefly describe those. The restrictions include a very specific consent form that the employee must sign that reveals that the employee is coming from this source of information, allows it to come from this source of information for the purpose of this one transaction and no others, and specifically reveals to the employee that if they rather use the old snail mail way, as we call it, that it wouldn't affect their loan application. So the employee has a choice. And if they choose not to, it is the old system works. There are benefits to employers, and that is that they don't get these pieces of paper that they have to process through their payroll department. There are benefits to employees in that it's a faster process to get a loan approved. There are obviously benefits to lenders as well. In the United Financial Lobby, the banks and credit unions and SMLs have authorized me to tell you that they support this bill. I think the one issue, and Annette will describe it for you in more detail, that has come up that has caused the employment department to move from a neutral position, which is where they were on the Senate side, to a opposed position, has to do with a policy decision for you that was also described when this bill was in front of the Senate, and that is, with the exception of releasing information to a whole variety of state agencies, from the state fire marshal to the Bureau of Labor to the Revenue Department, right now this information is not released except when an employee goes into a Department of Employment office and signs a little form. They can get the information themselves. And employers have tended to consider this to be their confidential information, and I can certainly understand why that is. If your whole payroll was released to somebody who could give it to your competitor, that might give your competitor a great deal of advantage. And what I think is different about this that should address those issues, although frankly the Employment Advisory Board of the department, which we've been working with over the last month or two, feels otherwise, is that this is only the release of one employee's information for a particular period of time with that employee. And frankly, it's the same information that employers are releasing by signing the regular old snail mail forms that are mailed to them. So it's nothing different than what they're releasing now, although the source is different. I would be happy to answer any questions about that issue or any others. Associate Oregon Industries, see, Earls asked me to pass out her testimony. With respect to this particular issue of employers being concerned about the confidentiality of their information, AOI has looked at this issue and specifically decided to support the bill, notwithstanding that, because of the benefits to employers by not having the paperwork through their personnel and payroll departments. But with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, you were just saying that basically the employee can go to the employment department and can get the information, right?
And that's how, but maybe I'll answer more specifically, but my understanding is that I was told that by employment division, the department staff, that the employee now can go to any one of the employment department offices and sign a form and get it released. The only reason that doesn't work for the purposes of this bill is those federally insured loan programs require it to come from an independent source, not through the employee's hands. But it is exactly the same information that would be going through this electronic access is now available to the employee if they go in and sign it.
So it is federal law that it requires it to come from an independent, from a third source?
It's the, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, it is the federal insurance programs, Federal Housing Administration, Federal VA, require all sorts of third-party verifications. For example, and yes, it is those requirements of those loan programs. For example, some FHA loan applications require you to be able to show that you have a certain amount of money in a bank account in terms of validating your assets and liabilities, and those loan programs do not allow the employee to bring in their bank statement, which is one way to show it. They require forms to be sent to banks and have the bank sign separately and mail them directly back to the lender. So it's a separation so that the borrower has no access directly to the information. It's all coming from third parties, and that is a requirement of those loan programs. To explain why I think that is, and it's not all loan programs, obviously, that have those requirements, those loan programs have very low down payments, and I think the feds, in their wisdom, if they're going to insure those loans so that the borrowers default, that the feds will pay the loan balance, and that's what those insurance programs do, FHA and VA. They have much stricter standards for approving the loan. It's consistent with the stricter standards that FHA has for appraisals of property. You may have heard, if you've ever tried to sell a house and somebody's going to buy it on an FHA loan, that somebody will come in and they'll find that your stair railing is 1 inch too high or too low, and that has to be corrected in order for FHA to qualify that property as well. So they're just much stricter than other kinds of loans.
Does anyone have any questions? Could the employment department you know, if an employee goes in and requests that information, signs the forms for the employment department rather than give it to them, mail it to, so. Maybe let a net giver test.
Mr. Chairman, I had to shake your head.
No, so
I'm familiar with the employment department's policy. So I based on her head shake, I'll
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Annette Talbot, a legislative coordinator for the Employment Department. Just to sort of recap what Mr. Cosgrove summarized, our advisory council, which is attached to my testimony, provides advice to the department. It does contain employer, labor, and public members who meet quarterly, although this legislative session they've been meeting monthly to try and give us additional advice during the legislative session. They had not taken a vote when this bill was up on the Senate side, so we reported to the Senate committee that they were concerned because historically they do view this data as employer data. It is reported on the employer's combined payroll report that goes to the Department of Revenue as well as to us. It's reported by individual Social Security number, and in fact, we understand sometimes we actually get sort of little envelopes with this in because they don't want the wage records of certain members of their corporation actually known by even other people in their own office. So the data is considered sensitive and proprietary in nature. So that is why the policy has been there before and is currently there, that the employer data is considered theirs and confidential. The only two instances, in response, Mr. Chair, to Representative Gardner's question, where we release that information is very limited, even to the individual themselves to whom the wages were paid. And that is they need to verify that the wages that are reported accurately because they're going to file a claim and to determine the amount of their claim might be. The other thing that you need to recognize is that, and I believe Mr. Cosgrove may be accurate in the large majority of cases, but there are income sources that people have that would not be taxable for purposes of unemployment insurance. So they would not actually show up on these forms. So this would not give someone, a consumer reporting agency or a lender, a complete picture necessarily of someone's wages because some things aren't subject to taxation and therefore would never show up on this form. So I think that's the other issue. We have struggled with this because we know that the bill in many respects can be considered an employer-friendly bill in the sense that their personnel staff then won't have to process all these requests for information. So I believe that's why you have Ms. Earls from AOI testifying in support of the bill. However, the majority, 7 out of 9 of our members, including employers and labor and public members, are very concerned about the bill in its present form because of two reasons, really. It sets a precedent that these confidential wages be released to a third private party. So that's one issue. The other is that it doesn't require the employer's consent to release the information. And since it is their data that they submit, we would ask the committee to seriously consider an amendment. And I believe that the advisory council would tell you, based on the poll that we took of each member, that if the bill did contain that they, even though it still sets a precedent, that they would feel much more comfortable that employers would have the option to decide not to make their wage data electronically available. We have what we call a program letter from the Federal Department of Labor, and the sponsor of the bill, the requester of the bill, has worked with us in many respects to get the bill to comply with that program letter. One of the requirements, and I will give this to the committee staff, Mr. Chair, though, is that states should seek the input of employers before entering into an agreement to release to a private entity. We have done that, and our input for our advisory council, except for Ms. Earls from AOI, is that they don't want it released unless employers have the option to opt out, at least, of the electronic system. If employers wanted to choose to do it the old-fashioned paper way through the mail, they should have that option. And the advisory council felt pretty strongly about that once we polled them. And we did provide them with Ms. Earl's testimony as well as our testimony so that they knew there were different positions out there. I have suggested, Mr. Chair, some possible language, which I think Mr. Cosgrove obviously would rather have a full database of employer wage records, and I think that we've just agreed to disagree on that. But that probably the least troublesome to him in terms of language would be to say that at least an employer could opt out of participating by checking some sort of box on their wage reporting form. And then if they were uncomfortable with the electronic release, they could have that option and still do it in the paper way. I think that the chair of the advisory council, Ms. Mayberry from Fred Meyer, has a lot of concerns about this, and she wished she had been here herself. She is sending a letter, and I will get it distributed to all the members, particularly about their concerns about confidentiality. And the further data gets away from its original source, the more likely it's shared for improper purposes. I think that's just sort of a given why all data is, when a privacy issue arises, you like to keep it kind of close to the vest. So that is their concern, but if there was at least some option for employers to opt out, they would be much more comfortable with the bill. And we do rely on them for advice on as many legislative pieces of that come up that we know they feel strongly about. I hope that you would consider their concerns, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
General Lundquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. On your advisory committee, I think I heard you say it was made of employers and public. How many employers and how many?
Mr. Chair, we have, I think, did you get a copy of our testimony?
I didn't look at the right.
Oh, it's
page.
Attached to that. We have.
Okay, I'm sorry, I just didn't turn the page.
We have five business now, only one public member at the current time, and three labor. Mr. Baxter is actually out of town, so he's been unavailable to give us his position. But the other business and labor members and the public member are in opposition in its current form because of their concern about that it is confidential and employer's data.
I apologize for that.
No problem.
I was listening instead of reading it.
I appreciate that.
yes. I'm not completely clear in my mind yet. Does this, what this bill proposes, does it change the opportunity for someone else to secure the information? I thought that right now you still do it you do it the slow way, and this is the fast way. Are we doing more than that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, what this would do would be allow a third party like VIE, Mr. Cosgrove's client, to access our wage records electronically. So they would be able to have all, access to all of our wage records, and they would, with the consent now of the employee only, be able to look at their wage records for the past 15 months. So right now, no one has electronic access to that data. Except for some other government agents.
I understand there's no electronic access to that, but even on the electronic, the employee has to give the consent.
The employee does.
So if they have to give the consent, they have to give the consent in both cases. Is that true? Under present system?
Present system, actually, the only reasons, Mr. Chair, Representative Lundquist, that the individuals can get it, the information, the wage records, is if they're going to file a claim or if they believe their wage records are inaccurate. In other words, they think that their employer didn't report all the wages that they earned. And that's for purposes, again, of the unemployment insurance claim. We do not give that information out unless the individual comes to us and says, I need it for one of those two purposes. Otherwise, we would be the wage verifier of all kinds of things. And again, that is not our job. We don't verify that the employer reported those wage records accurately unless we're doing audits. They're not collected for purposes of some third party looking at them. They're collected for purposes of taxation. I guess a good analogy is the Department of Revenue would never give out the wage data that they get from employers. And we see ourselves as an insurance company and a tax agency just like them. I'm sure people would love to get access to their records as well, but they don't let them. So that's how employers view their tax data and insurance information as well. It's something they see as confidential, and so they are nervous about having, even though, and this is not to say that Mr. Cosgrove's clients would misuse the data, but we do know of instances where that kind of data is misused, misreported, so that's their concern. Over time.
And that, you said for 15 months of information?
I believe it's 15 quarters. If I said 15 months, I apologize.
The way I read the bill, it's 15 quarters, right. And you said 15 months, so I was frankly
concerned
where else.
Chair.
The bill that was spoke to months. Oh, okay. Mr.
Chairman, if I may, if Representative Lundquist's question was, I may have misunderstood as well, is this any different from employers signing consent to get this by hard copy of the old-fashioned way? No, except that the consent form to get it electronically is much more detailed than the consent form to get it electronically, because U.S. Department of Labor has made it much more detailed. So that issue. I guess I would just have one response. It is sensitive information. That's one of the reasons why we believe that consumers choose to use this in the six states that they can, because, in fact, then the very fact that they're applying for a loan and who they're applying for from a loan is not known to the personnel department. In a small company, that information goes through a number of hands before the information is returned, and so it's an element of confidentiality for employees by this new system. And secondly, I'd just like to point out that although the information is about employees and their wages and their Social Security numbers, this only works, of course, if the employees have employees supposed and they agree to that. What we're really talking here about is about whether employers want to have that released. An opt-out would mean the system wouldn't work, because if we can't guarantee to our creditors that all of the wages, and this Talbot is correct, they're thinking they're non-wages, they're also income, but if all the wages aren't in the system, then we can't tell them, they can't rely on the electronic access. And that's our only concern about an opt-out, is the system just doesn't work with an opt-out, because we can't guarantee that it has the universe of people who have reported. I'd be glad to answer any other questions. I just want to make this statement.
Mr. Chair, if I might just sum up, if that would be okay. I do believe that employers do understand that in some instances that this would be a saver to them in terms of work, but I do also understand that employers at some time would have reason to say that they just didn't want their wage records out. We see, I take a look at what this wage report form, and I can leave it for the chair. It includes a lot of things.
Do I fill those out every quarter?
Okay, then you know that there are a lot of data in there that you perhaps wouldn't want other people to get a hold of, including your pay range and your scale and the type of employees that you hire. So, in summary, I guess that when we did take a look at the program letter the Department of Labor gives us, they also do ask to seek the input of employers. When we did that with our advisory council, what they told us was, you know, please oppose the bill in its current form. So I believe if the committee would direct us to that, we could work out some language that would allow an opt-out, which is probably the least damaging to the system as opposed to an opt-in. And we would be glad to work with Mr. Cosgrove on that language if the committee directs us to.
And that, exactly which part of that form gets forwarded to your office? Because I'm going over in my mind now the quarterly report, and I send them to the Department of Revenue.
Right.
Which is it? Is it the OQ?
It's the 132 report, employee detail.
So, and on that report, if I remember, is name, Social Security number, hours worked, and the amount of wages for the quarter. Those four things, the only thing on the 132. So we're not talking about any sensitive information other than those, that's the four things that you get in your office.
Mr. Chair, you know the form better than I, but Social Security, first and last name, total hours worked, and subject wages. Those were the
ones. And I would just add, Mr. Chairman, when we set up the program to get electronic access, we set it up in such a way that there's a firewall between their computer and ours, so that the only information we can get is name, Social Security number, and total wages through the effective period. That is a computer that we set up when we programmed this, that we don't have access. We don't move the whole database into ours. We only get into it for the purpose of one request to get one person's, or if they're two borrowers, two people's wages from the employers. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify in this bill? If no one, will close the public hearing on Title 26. Committee members, I think I will hold this over till Friday. Let the committee members think about it for 2 days. If someone wants to have a member craft to work with the people, you're welcome to do so, or ask Mr. Putman to do so and bring them back. But we'll put it on Friday's schedule and make a decision at that time on it. Mr. Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask for reconsideration of Senate Bill 459, which is a skinny street bill. League of Oregon Cities intended, and LCDC will testify if they have an opportunity. They missed it. And they didn't do it on the Senate side, and they didn't do it here because it slipped by them, but they would like to be heard on this before we send it onto the floor with a due pass recommendation.
There's a new request. We have a 5-minute recess, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we've got 4 and 15
yeah.
minutes.
Well, it's just that I did talk to Phil Fell, and he apologized profusely. He intended to be here, but he missed it. They missed it on the Senate side, but he said LCDC would want to be heard, I think, in opposition to a uniform 20-foot street. And so there are cities, including my own city, who require full development. I mean, those streets are going to be there forever. Those housing parks may not be, but I think that, and I did vote to pass it out of committee with the idea that I may speak against it on the floor, but I think it would be well, it would serve us well if we had an opportunity to hear the full argument.
Are they here now?
No. No, LCD, they're not.
I'm very concerned.
Well, for what it's worth, I would request that we put it over till reconsider and hear it on Friday.
It would take a suspension of rules. No, I don't think it would right now because it's still on the schedule for today. Is that correct?
We'll fix whatever you do.
I will open a work session on Senate Bill 459. Representative Morissette, you voted on the prevailing side.
And I would move to reconsider.
Without objection. Okay, without objection from the committee, we would reconsider the vote by which we passed Senate Bill 459. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Morissette, would you like to make a motion that we bring the bill back?
I would move that we bring the bill back on Friday.
Okay, Representative Morissette would move that we officially reconsider, I guess that we do reconsider the vote on which we passed Senate Bill 459. Is there objection to that motion? Seeing none, so ordered. We now have the bill back before us. We will put it back on Friday's schedule.
Thank you,
Morissette. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 459. And I think that was a bill I was carrying, so I remember right.
Notify the carrier.
Okay, please notify the carrier.
Better notify.
With that, we will open a public hearing on SCR 3. Don't ask me, members, why we have SCR in our committee, but here it is. Mr. Orloff, are you here to talk about this bill? Come on up. Mr. Putman, you want to give us a brief introduction?
This is a Senate concurrent resolution. Would require a vote of the House. As I understand it, it does not go to the governor, but I'm not positive on that. This supports the activities planned for national and state commemoration of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, which is coming up in 4 years.
Go ahead, Mr. Orloff, and Julie Curtis, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Chet Forloff. I'm the director of the Oregon Historical Society, the immediate past president of the National Lewis and Clark Bicentennial Council, and secretary of our state's Lewis and Clark organization, Lewis and Clark Bicentennial in Oregon. Actually, there is a good reason for this bill to be in this committee. The Lewis and Clark expedition was, first and foremost, a business expedition.
It was labor.
It was sent out here by President Jefferson with the intention of commerce was actually its larger mission, but the purpose was to investigate business opportunities for the new American Republic in the new West. In 1900, turn of the century,
the Oregon Historical Society initiated planning for the centennial celebration, commemoration of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And what happened at that point in 1905 was a World's Fair, the Lewis and Clark exposition, Oriental Fair, which even at the end of this century, we might mark as one of the largest economic development initiatives in this century. The state grew by more than 70% in the 10 years following the exposition. Not that we are suggesting that that will be the result of the bicentennial commemoration by any means, but there was a strong economic factor in that commemoration. As well, there was a strong educational focus for it. The bicentennial is getting off to an even more ambitious beginning. We have been at work since the early 1990s, getting to plan the bicentennial commemoration. It is a much more collaborative effort involving public and private bodies from throughout the state and across the trail, 11 trail states to Virginia and nationwide. I would say that Oregon actually has a better start than other states along that trail. I think because we have brought more organizations and agencies to the table to collaborate in the planning effort. This particular concurrent resolution does not carry any financial implications. There is some funding, modest though it is, in the state parks budget under the Oregon Heritage Commission, which would appropriate $100,000 $100,000 to support the beginning work of this effort, Lewis and Clark Bicentennial in Oregon, for the next biennium. We would also be raising private dollars to match state funding. So I would urge this committee's passage of SCR 3, formally acknowledging Oregon's recognition of the forthcoming bicentennial of Lewis and Clark.
I wish that you had brought more detailed information about what you plan to do at that time. I think it's a great idea, and I certainly will support this, but I'm wondering if, well, I just would like more information, and I'm wondering about the state involvement with revenue. If you have enough money, where are we going to get it? I think probably you should be asking for more money. And I hate to see it come out of the state park fund. I would like to, you know, I would like you to think about that. And I don't want to mess up your plans right now, and I will support this recommendation, but I have a feeling that you're being a little bit conservative in what you're asking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morsett, very good point. Right now, the effort is to begin planning, or continue planning that effort. And there are a number of substantial initiatives in place, one being Oregon will be the venue for the 2005-2006 National Exhibition, which is a major national exhibition that's being planned already, that will visit about 5 venues throughout the country. As well, we will be putting historic signage along the Columbia River from Umatilla through Clatsop counties, marking the Lewis and Clark Trail. And there are a number of other educational, historic preservation, commemorative event kinds of programs that are in the offing. Right now, we thought conservatively that until we had a more refined plan that we could attach numbers, defensible numbers to, it was presumptuous of us to come forward with a proposal, because I think the response would be, show us more detail before we can do that. By the end of this forthcoming biennium, I can guarantee that we will come forward with a much more ambitious, detailed proposal to the people of Oregon for public support for this bicentennial. I thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Thank you very much for bringing this forward. Do you have anything else to add?
Just for the record, my name is Julie Curtis, and I'm the current halftime manager of the Heritage Commission. I also have been with the Oregon Tourism Commission for 11 years as the assistant director, so just wanted to go on record to support and actually to thank the legislature for recognizing the importance of the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, and to also comment that this is something that, from both the heritage and tourism perspectives, we see as very important for Oregon. We were very involved in the Oregon Trail celebration in 1993 and would hope to carry on that kind of collaborative work among state agencies, the private sector, and certainly tourism and heritage organizations throughout the state as well as the country to make sure that Oregon commemorates the bicentennial in a way that will make all of our state proud. And I want to just comment also on Representative Morissette's comments about possibly not having enough money in the budget, and echo Chet's comments that we see this $100,000 really as seed money to go to the Lewis and Clark nonprofit so that they can start bringing in those private sector matching dollars and leveraging that state funding in order for us to make this very successful. So I appreciate your comments.
Thank you. We will close the public hearing and move to work session. Representative Atkinson.
Sure, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 3 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 to the floor with the due pass. Is there a discussion on the motion?
Only, I'll just say information, I guess, FYI. I think this is a much bigger thing than most people in Oregon think it will be at the present time. I know when people around the schools and going to Astoria and then that area, of course, you know, they're going to be a major recipient of huge numbers of people. I mean, just the logistics are going to be fantastic. The rest of you, some of you may have read, or maybe all have read, Undaunted Courage. But if you haven't, that is an absolute must book that you read before this happens. It'll give you a much more, gave me anyway, a lot greater and this appreciation of what Lewis and Clark really did.
Is that the book that those the journals?
Yeah, it's right. It's a very thick book. It goes in great detail.
I have read the journals of Lewis and Clark, but I don't. Is that the name of that?
No, I think this is more than
Stephen Ambrose.
Yeah,
Ambrose.
And Don Courage. And that's some of you have probably read that anyway. But it really does give a great appreciation for the.
Oh, the journals of Lewis and Clark are very fascinating to read. Also, I have heard that. Thank you. Any other discussion?
I didn't read the book. I saw the movie.
Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Atkinson will carry the motion.
We are adjourned.